The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the golden age of radio, the adventures of Captain Courage, an interview with stuntman Cliff Lyons on the Daredevils of Hollywood, and Drums Along the River on an episode of High Adventure. Stay tuned for the golden age of radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, an interview with motion picture stuntman Cliff Lyons on the Daredevils of Hollywood and Drums Along the River on an episode of High Adventure. Right now, the adventures of Captain Courage as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Adventure of Captain Courage, being the first in the Monday through Friday entries transcribed from the log of the ship Falcon. We invite you to join us each evening at this time as we present the story of an American sailing captain and his ship, whose cargo is action, intrigue, and romance, as it burns across the pages of America's sailing history. And now, starring Ted DeCorsia, we present the Adventure of Captain Courage.
This being the first entry to be read from the log of the schooner Falcon. 2nd October, 1810, Long Wharf, New Bedford. She's as ready as she might be. We could wish for a new set of sail. Those we have are as patched as a mate's work trousers. But we'll have to do. She's not pretty to look at, being in need of paint and general outfitting. But with our first cargo in 6 months, we'll have enough money to put her in top shape. To make her what she really is. The fastest and best schooner on the Atlantic seaboard. All going well, today my mate, Mr. Bragg, will be signing up the crew. The weather is moderate, a pleasant breeze and cloudy. Christopher Courage, master.
I don't like the look of those rattlings, Mr. Bragg.
Aye, Captain. I don't either. But that's not convincing the outfitters to give us new rope. Can't you get just a little out of Marlin? Hard money's what they want, Chris. Are you going ashore?
Yes.
Well, you might stop by and see what you can do. They told me no more credit. And we need topsail sheet blocks, quarter blocks, about 40 fathoms of cable, not to talk about carpenter tackle and provisions. And the sails. Oh, Chris, the first gale we hit...
We've got this far, Tom. We'll make out. So stop your howling and see what you can dig up for a crew. I'll be at Marlin's on Water Street if you want me.
A crew? What am I supposed to offer him for pay?
I don't care what you offer him. Get me a crew, mister.
Hey, you.
You calling me?
I ain't talking to the wind. You know of a ship in these parts looking for a good hand? I sailed bosun last voyage. Things is almighty tight now, though. Haven't felt the sea under me for nigh on to 3 months.
Well, then you're in luck, mister. I'm looking for a crew.
You? What's your ship?
Falcon, yonder.
Yes, scurvy-looking barge. I ain't looking for a slaver nor a hog pen.
She's neither, mister.
What's your name?
Courage. Christopher Courage.
Courage. I wouldn't have judged so by the cut of you.
Now step aside, mister. I'm late for an appointment.
Walk around me, then.
Mister, I put on a clean shirt this morning. I don't want it fouled with your blood.
Oh, Captain Dear, I love you for saying that.
You shouldn't have done that, mister.
I like you better, Christopher Courage. The last man I hit like that stayed asleep for 2 days.
You need some help, Chris?
No, thank you, Tom. Now, mister.
Cold this morning.
That helps to cool a man off.
I'm obliged to you. I haven't enjoyed a fight as much for a long time. I like your name, Captain. And I like you. I always wanted to serve under a man who could whip me. If you've no hard feelings, sir, will you sign me aboard?
I've no hard feelings. What's your name?
Silas Davenport. I got me papers. What though they be? Where's the Falcon bound?
I was on my way to find that out.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'd like to be with you.
Tom!
Aye, sir.
This is Mr. Davenport. You can sign him on as bosun.
Am I going to have to fight him, Bob?
Not today, mister. I had enough today.
One thing, Davenport.
Aye, sir.
As you can see, Falcon carries no guns.
Letters of marque to make a privateer come expensive these days. $20,000 it costs from the last I heard.
That's true. I want you to know the risk when we sail.
I'll take the risk. And happy, too.
Good. You can help Mr. Bragg round out the crew. I'll be back later.
Aye, aye, sir.
Hey, Captain. I'm sorry I got your shirt dirty.
Well, well, Captain Courage. What a pleasure, sir. Oh, but you met with an accident, sir. You're not sure.
The accident happened to somebody else, sir. I must apologize for my appearance.
Oh, no apologies are necessary, sir. None at all. Sit down.
Oh, thank you.
How are we progressing?
Well, the Falcon's ready to sail, as ready as she ever will be, Mr. Marlin.
Excellent.
I'd feel a sight more comfortable, though, if I had some money to...
But you haven't, Captain. I'm speculating on this voyage every bit as much as you are. The consignment has taken my last penny. The rest is up to you.
Yes. All right. What about the cargo? When do you want me to start loading?
Oh, the cargo, yes. Well, immediately, Captain, as soon as you possibly can.
Good. Now, I think we'd better get down to those details you passed by when you hired me.
The details. Oh, yes. Well, I'd say that they were more in the nature of provisions than details, Captain.
Provisions?
The cargo consists of sugar, tobacco, and assorted goods. They are sacked and kegged and waiting in my warehouse. You will ask no questions about it, nor about your destination.
What? I don't understand. You hire me to carry a cargo and you won't tell me where?
As far as you and the customs authorities are concerned, you are shipping my cargo to Martinique.
Well, that's fine, but where am I really taking it?
Your sailing orders will be delivered to you 10 minutes before weighing anchor. However, I can tell you that you'll be bound for a West Indies port.
Smuggling? Now, Mr. Marlin.
Oh, I've said nothing about smuggling. Oh, believe me, sir, the cargo will be inspected and found to be in perfect order.
Hmm. Oh, that's one of the provisions, Mr. Marlin. You said there were others.
Oh, one other, Captain. Come with me, please. This is my other provision, sir. My niece, Miss Nancy Marlin. Captain Courage, my dear. You remember my speaking of him. He's in command of the Falcon.
Captain?
Miss Marlin.
She will be a passenger aboard your ship.
No, sir.
No?
I am not carrying women on my ship, Mr. Marlin. I'm sorry.
There is a distinction, Captain, between what you call women and a lady. I should be happier if you'd recognize that distinction.
Captain, consider your circumstances, if you will.
I have. I'm aware of them.
There are many ships in New Bedford and few merchants with the will to allow their cargoes to sail. Thus, we would have no problem in obtaining ourselves another captain. Am I correct, sir?
Completely, sir. So, obtain yourself another captain. I've never taken a lady aboard a ship of mine, and I don't intend to start now. There's no decent cabin. You know what the Falcon is. She's a merchantman. Fast enough, but room for cargo and crew, and that's all.
Oh, I'm aware of that, but I'm sure you could somehow, during the time it takes you to load, put together makeshift quarters so that Miss Marlin would be reasonably comfortable.
Mr. Marlin, I think what you're trying to say is that if I don't agree to carry this passenger, you're no longer interested in my commission.
I should hate to put it that way, sir.
Yeah, but at the risk of hating yourself, you do put it that way.
You don't think that I'd find it any less distasteful than you, do you, Captain? I can think of traveling in far more pleasant surroundings than you have to offer.
But look here, sir.
No, you look, Mr. Marlin. I need your cargo. I need it badly. Well, you've asked me to close my eyes about my sailing orders. Now you want me to take her with me. There's enough trouble at sea between the French and English. I'm willing to take the risk with your cargo if you are, but I'm not taking the risk of your niece. I'm sorry.
Captain, I will give you and every one of your crew a handsome bonus when you make safe delivery.
Just as you said, Mr. Marlin. New Bedford is packed with sailing masters who jump at the chance of a cargo. I'd be happy to recommend two or three.
You're the man I want for the job.
I'm sorry.
Just a moment, Captain, if you please. There is the matter of a written contract between us bearing your signature. That is correct, is it not?
Tear it up.
But I do not wish to tear it up. I wish it to be fulfilled.
Not by me.
By you, Captain Courage.
Take it to the courts.
Oh, I shan't have to. It's binding. This has been proved in the courts. Do you know, sir, that I could quite easily have your master's license revoked were you to refuse compliance with your contract?
I've decided something, Mr. Marlin. I don't like you or anything you ever say.
Oh, possibly so. But we return to the matter of the contract.
What happens if I go to customs and inform them that you're falsifying the sailing orders?
I shall tell them that you're lying. Besides which, I haven't said that you're not sailing for Martinique. It's not against the authority laws to give you sailing orders when and as I please.
It's not in my contract to carry passengers.
Exactly. Neither is it in your contract that you shan't carry them. That, my dear sir, is at the discretion of the merchant. I am the merchant. I request you to carry Miss Marlin. Either that or...
When do you want me to sail?
As soon as the cargo is aboard. Oh, it should take no more than 3 days to load.
I'll take no responsibility for Miss Marlin's safety, whatever happens to her.
We both understand, Captain.
All right.
Oh, good man, good. I feel this is the beginning of a most happy relationship. And now, sir, I think a glass of wine is indicated to wish the bargain well. You'll join us?
Oh, yes, Captain. Please do.
Thank you, ma'am. No. I find it necessary to do business with your uncle, but I'll drink with whom I please. Good afternoon.
Yeah. Evening, Chris.
Where have you been? It's 8 bells.
Where have I been? Did you send me out to buy you a crew, or did you not?
And how many pints of rum did you pour into yourself?
Oh, now, Captain, it takes talk to get a crew. Friendly talk. Well, the men want to feel their mate's one of the lads. Yeah, I made him feel that. Besides that eight-man Davenport, we've got a starter of 19 and a ship's carpenter among them.
Not enough. We need 40. We sail on Friday.
Well, it's more like how many more we'll be lucky to get. I had 8 more ready to sign on till they saw our lovely Falcon, and they wouldn't have none of her.
Tom, I want 40.
Well, it won't be easy, Chris. The Falcon's no screaming beauty, the new, and there's not many good men in New Bedford to be had.
We'll find them. Oh, there's one other thing, mister.
Hey, what's that?
A passenger will be coming aboard probably Friday.
Well, that's all right.
We're going to have to... Yes?
Captain Courage, will you kindly get someone to carry my luggage to my cabin? I shall be remaining on your ship until we sail.
The Adventure of Captain Courage, starring Ted DeCorsia, is produced, written, and directed in Hollywood by Anthony Ellis and William Conrad. Listen again tomorrow night to another in the Monday through Friday entries transcribed from the log of the ship Falcon. The story of a man who filled the pages of America's sailing history with action and romance. Tomorrow night, Christopher Courage is faced with the problem of having to create living quarters aboard the Falcon for Nancy Marlin, the girl who is to have a great effect on the captain's future. This is the CBS Radio Network.
When you ask your grocer for the new Rinso, buy a cake of Lifebuoy at the same time. Lifebuoy's rich, purifying lather goes right after dirt and perspiration, leaves you feeling extra clean. So use Lifebuoy daily in your bath or shower. Remember, it's the only soap especially made to stop...
Introducing... The Daredevils of Hollywood.
Boys, keep those cameras turning. Keep those sirens going. I'm going to jump. Hey, you fellas with the net, come in a little closer. Joe, make that spotlight a little hotter.
Yeah, that's a feature of a fire, Mr. Baker. This ought to make a swell scene.
Yeah, well, it's costing enough money.
Holy cats, look, the whole roof is about to fall in.
Good heavens. Jump!
Bill, jump! Look out!
Run!
There he comes! Steady with the net, men! He made it! Okay for camera on that.
Okay, here, show he got it.
It's okay for me. Print that one. Say, that was a sweet jump, Bill. Got out just in time. You all right?
Oh, sure. Sure, I'm okay.
That's all for tonight. Call for 8 o'clock in the morning, everybody. Stage 9.
From the motion picture capital of the world, we bring you the thrilling true life experiences of those men behind the scenes. Those daring, unsung heroes whose breathtaking adventures on the screen have thrilled millions. Whose daily jobs bring them face to face with death. Those men who comprise the strangest fraternity on earth. The Suicide Squad. The movie stuntmen. The Daredevils of Hollywood.
Ladies and gentlemen, in bringing you this copyrighted feature, we are privileged to have as our guest one of the top-notch stuntmen of Hollywood, Cliff Lyons. It is through his cooperation that we are able to reenact some of the highlights of his dangerous profession. The thrilling scenes you are about to hear are his own actual experiences. Cliff Lyons is here in the studio right now. And later in the program, we will bring him to the microphone. But first, let us learn something of his job.
It is a beautiful afternoon in 1924. The Ben Wilson Company is on location near Inglewood, California. They have been shooting scenes all day, but the big moment is about to arrive. The story calls for a very dangerous scene, and the man who is to do that scene, Cliff Lyons, is just coming on the location set. Francis Ford, the director, greets him.
Well, hi, Cliff.
Hello, Mr. Ford.
See, you're just about on time. We're almost ready for your scene.
Okay, what's the gag?
Well, you see that train standing down there about a half a mile?
Yep.
And there's another one waiting down there a half mile in the opposite direction. Now, we're going to start this train coming toward us. You're supposed to drive a car along the highway there, parallel with the tracks.
I see.
Now, the train will beat your car to the crossing by about 50 feet. So you turn down the tracks and run alongside the train.
I get it. You mean drive between the double tracks with the train.
That's right. Now, the idea is to transfer from the car to the train. You just crawl through a window in the coach and let the car go.
Yeah, I see. But what about the other car?
Well, now, that'll be coming from the opposite direction on the other track. Your job is to get through that window just before the two trains meet.
Okay, that's good enough for me. But that car, it's going to be a mess.
Yes, it'll fold up like an accordion between the trains. But let's hope you're out of it by that time.
We're ready for the test with the trains, Mr. Ford.
All right, I'm right with you. Well, Cliff, you all set?
Yeah, but there's a little timing I want to do first.
Okay. But be sure your watch doesn't stop.
Three times the scene is rehearsed. Speeds of the moving train are carefully checked and rechecked, timed to the split second. The engineers, obviously nervous, are instructed by Mr. Lyons and Mr. Ford in each minute detail. Everyone is stationed at his post. Cameras are set. Tension dominates the scene. The slightest mistake will cost a human life. Far apart, facing each other, the two trains stand motionless, puffing like two spirited horses, tense with apprehension. While far down the highway, Cliff Lyons, calmly, almost nonchalantly, crawls into the car and sits relaxed, awaiting the signal to start. The director is giving last-minute instructions.
Okay, we're ready to shoot. Everybody on his toes. This is a take.
Hi. This is the picture. All ready, everybody?
Yeah, we're all set, Mr. Ford.
All right. Give him the signal.
Here they come.
Yeah. So far, so good.
Man, is that train bowling the jack?
I'm afraid it's coming too fast.
Keep those cameras going.
Chris got that bus wide open. Looks like it's about to fall apart.
He's making the turn at the crossing. Look at him bumping alongside that train.
He's got, but look at the other train. It's coming like a bullet. He'll never make it. He won't have time.
He's got to make it. Get in that window, Cliff, quick!
He's got his hands on the windowsill. Climb in that window, Cliff. Hurry! Hurry!
If that boy's alive, it's a miracle. Come on, let's run down there. There he is. Getting off the train. He's all right. Come on.
Was that all right, Mr. Ford? Did you get a good shot?
I'll say we got a shot. We lost two cameras in the crash, but we got a beauty with the other one. I thought you were a goner for a minute. Phew. That was too close.
Yeah, it was plenty close, all right. I guess those engineers got excited. They were a little heavy on the throttle.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is our pleasure to present the courageous young man who daily laughs in the face of death and who made that scene, Cliff Lyons, interviewed by Kurt Foreman.
That certainly was a thrilling stunt, Cliff, and I'd say you were pretty lucky.
Yeah, I guess I was at that.
Tell me, what was your reaction when you saw the trains approaching each other so fast?
All I was interested in was getting through that window.
Well, were you scared?
Oh, not exactly. I was too busy to be scared, but I felt a little funny when it was all over.
Say, Cliff, have you ever been really scared?
Well, now, do you want the truth?
The whole truth?
Well, yes. I have been scared.
And when was that?
Right now.
You mean this microphone?
Yeah, it's almost got me.
Well, I wouldn't let that get you down. Now, you do all kinds of stunts, don't you?
That's right, but my favorite is horse stunts. You know, high jumps, falls, and dives into water on horseback, things like that.
Did you ever have any close calls while doing these stunts?
Yes, I have. I remember once on a stagecoach gag...
Just a minute. Did you say gag?
Yeah, we call them gags. Well, this stagecoach was supposed to run down a steep mountain road. And on a sharp curve, the horse is to break loose and make a turn while the stagecoach goes over the embankment, drops about 200 feet. Well, it was down on location at Calabasas, California. That's about 20 miles from Hollywood. Johnny Mac Brown was making a Western picture. Henry McRae, the director, was explaining to me how the gag worked.
I see, Cliff. We've got an airplane cable tied to the doubletree. And when the coach gets the turn, we'll pull the cable and release the horses.
And that's when I jump, huh?
Right. But don't hesitate. That hack is going to sail off into space like a bird.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, boys. We're ready to go.
Okay.
Row them. Go ahead, Cliff.
Hey, look, Mac. Something's gone wrong. The coach is making the turn.
Yes, but the horses are loose. Look, the stage is running wild down the hill.
Gosh, I'd hate to be in that guy's shoes. Watch him. He's going to jump.
He's all tangled up in the lines. There he goes. Look, the horses are dragging him. Stop those horses, men. Stop them.
There goes the coach over the bank. Look at that.
You must have been pretty badly hurt in that scene, weren't you, Cliff?
No, just scratched up a little. The wagon ran over my arm and bruised a little bit, but I was okay.
And how far did the horses drag you?
Oh, about 200 feet, but it seemed like a mile.
Tell me, something went wrong there. Whose fault was that?
Oh, I guess somebody got excited and didn't pull the cable soon enough. Things like that often happen. People on the ground make mistakes. Maybe they cut a rope too soon or something like that.
What usually happens to you stuntmen when your helpers make a mistake?
Well, it just puts us in a tough spot, that's all.
And what happens when you make a mistake?
Well, in that case, we just have to do stunts for St. Peter.
Cliff, how long have you been doing stunts for the movies?
A little over 17 years.
Say, that's quite a long time to be taking chances for a living.
Oh, I guess you get used to it.
I understand there have been quite a number of stuntmen killed. What about that?
Well, I'd say about 300 have been killed and motion pictures started.
And what about the fellows who are working now? How many are there active?
Well, there are about 30 recognized stuntmen. Of course, sometimes the stand-ins and a few extras will do easy things, such as falling downstairs or rolling down a cliff. We call those bumps men.
Tell me, Cliff, what's the difference between a stuntman and a bumps man?
Well, when a bumps man makes a mistake, he breaks an arm or a leg. But when a stuntman misses, it's curtains.
Say, I imagine you stuntmen carry considerable insurance.
Well, now, there's where you're wrong. The cost is terrific. Why, I recall an incident where a producer balked at a certain price I'd given him for a stunt. I told him I'd reduce the figure 90% if he'd take out some life insurance for me. He called Lloyd's of London and found that the premium covering the one stunt that I was to do was greatly in excess of the price that I'd given him originally. Since that time, we very seldom have any trouble in getting the prices we request.
Well, Cliff, you certainly entertained us. And on behalf of our listeners, I want to sincerely thank you for coming here. I know that everyone joins me in hoping that we may have you on this program again very soon. Good luck, old boy.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio with a focus on motion picture stuntman Cliff Lyons. We also heard an episode of The Adventures of Captain Courage. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Here's an episode of High Adventure entitled Drums Along the River, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Tonight's story by Ron Evans is entitled Drums Along the River.
How many of you ladies listening in actually use lava soap? We'd like to hear why you like lava and any new uses you found for it. Write in, will you? Who knows, maybe we'll read your letter over the air. Now, wouldn't that give you a thrill? And ladies, always remember this. When it comes to getting extra dirty, housework soiled hands really clean, no other nationally known toilet soap you've ever used equals lava. Lava soap. LAVA. And remember, let us know how you like it.
At this moment, a great road is being laid through the dense Brazilian jungle in an attempt to open up this vast territory for settlers. Before this could be done, several aerial surveys had to be made, since many hundreds of miles of road were to be laid where no civilized human had been before. My name is Ken Driver. I'm a geologist, working for an international mineral exportation company in Brazil. A female colleague, Sue Nolan, and I had been invited by Art Munro, an American surveyor, to visit a small jungle outpost near the Colombian border for a few days. The small outpost was accessible only from the air, and the three of us set off from a small town on the banks of the Amazon in a plane piloted by Rico Gomes, one of the few men who was familiar with the area and the Indian tongues.
The river looks so beautiful from up here. Inviting.
An invitation to death, Miss Nolan.
It's so hard to believe.
That river is full of piranhas, and on the banks you'll find anacondas big enough to swallow a man.
And not only that, Mr. Munro. There are the Indios with their poison darts. It's Hafsha country. Headhunters.
Glad I'm up here. I hope it's not like that at the camp you're taking us to.
Oh, the camp Orono is all right. So long as you don't try to bathe in the river. It's been cut out of the riverbank and is stockaded. The government has a small detachment of soldiers stationed there. No danger, so long as you follow the rules.
What time will we get there, Rika?
About an hour. Just about 10.
I'm beginning to wonder whether it wouldn't have been better to have spent my 2 weeks leave in Rio. By now, I'd be lying on Copacabana Beach, soaking up the sun.
You told me you were the adventurous type of girl.
I am. So long as I'm surrounded by the comforts of home.
You mean like TV, restaurants, and ice cream?
You got the idea.
You won't find anything like that at Borono, Miss Nolan. I think you will find it interesting in many other ways.
Rico, what's wrong?
You old blockage, I think.
Oh, heavens, no! Do something, Rico!
Oh, please, miss, I'm doing all I can.
We're loose.
Rico, are you crying?
Relax, Sue. Rico's doing his best. There's nothing else I can do except crash land.
The river. You can do a belly flop into it. Maybe we'll
that
be able...
That way we'll end up as food for the piranha. I'll have to use the trees to soften the landing. Please fasten your belts.
Oh, what an unholy mess. Can't you send out a distress signal?
No time. Hold tight.
The plane hit the tops of the trees, spun and tore its way through to the lower branches, coming to rest a few feet above the ground, cradled between two huge trees. Rico had made a magnificent job of it, and apart from a few bruises and scratches, none of us was hurt.
Are you okay, Sue?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm okay, too. Rico?
Just a small cut on my arm. No, Mr. Munro, don't move around. As you can see, we're balancing between two trees.
By golly, you're right! It's a miracle.
Brilliant landing, Rico. We must get away from the plane quickly before the Indians come. This is an automatic My Day call, but I doubt it will help much. We must get to the river and follow it westwards and pray the Indians don't come after us.
How are we going to get out of the plane without disturbing the balance?
One at a time, very carefully. There's some rope in the back. You can go down first, Mr. Munro, and then Mr. Driver, and I will lower down Miss Nolan.
I used to be good climbing up and down ropes at school.
Here's the rope. I'll just force open this door. Oh, come on, darn you! That's it.
Do you hear that?
What? Yes, it's a drum.
That's why we must hurry. The Indians have seen our landing.
We climbed out of the plane without any trouble. Down on the ground, it was damp, and our feet sank deeply into the decaying vegetable matter. Above our heads, the tall trees completely blotted out the sky, and it was as though we were standing in the nave of a vast, darkened cathedral. Rico led the way toward the river. It was hard going.
Oh, I must rest a minute. Get my breath back.
Please, Miss Nolan, force yourself.
I can't. I'm out of condition.
Oh, come off it, Rico. I mean, it won't make any difference.
I'm being watched right now, I'm sure of it.
Listen to those drums. They're much closer than before.
Well, I can't see anyone.
You won't see me. The Indians are masses of camouflage. You hear those bird calls?
Yeah.
Some are genuine. But others are the Indians calling to each other.
Yeah. What the heck?
What's wrong?
Well, something stuck into my arm. Yeah. Look at that. It's like a super splinter.
Let me see. A blowpipe.
It's beginning to hurt.
Shh. You hear that?
Yes. A voice from over there.
It's in Lavsha language. An order not to kill any more of us.
What does he mean by that? None of us is dead yet.
Mr. Monroe, the doctor is poisoned.
Oh, no. You mean that I...
Here's my knife. Come on. Maybe we can cut out the poison.
It's too late. Help him sit down.
You mean there's nothing you can do? My neck. It's gone stiff.
Please, there must be something. Art?
Yes, let me look at him. He's gone.
Ken, what are we going to do?
Nothing. Look around us.
We blinked through the jungle gloom and saw we were completely surrounded by semi-naked tribesmen, some carrying small bows and others holding six-foot-long blowpipes. We were unarmed, helpless. With agonizing slowness, they closed in on us. One, who was wearing a tall headdress of mud and feathers, obviously the leader, was addressed by Rico.
Wasame Melulu.
What'd he say?
I asked him what he wanted of us. He said he won't be hurt. We don't try to run away. He's telling us to follow.
Let's go, then. Where there's life, there's hope. You all right, Sue?
Do we have to leave poor Art lying there?
Have we a choice? Come on, lass. Whatever happens to Art now, he won't feel it. As we moved off, I was glad Sue didn't look back to where two of the Indians had started to remove Art's head. Rico had been right. We were prisoners of a tribe of headhunters. We walked for what seemed like miles. In the distance, I could hear the river, and soon we came into a clearing filled with rush huts. A large crowd of women, old men, and children were already assembled for our arrival. They poked and pulled at us as though we were strange new creatures, which we were to them. However, on the chief's orders, the escort formed a ring around us and kept them at bay.
What are they waiting for?
You can speak their language. Doesn't it give a clue as to what they have in mind?
Dialect is difficult to follow because they speak more quickly than the other options I've run into. Something about a priest.
A priest?
Yes, a priest of some god. No, not a god. I heard the word Shamasa, which means doctor. But it was prefixed by Ma, which means god.
So?
So it means god doctor.
So they're waiting for the priest to the god doctor.
Will his arrival do us any good? That's what interests me most.
I don't think so, Miss Nolan. No white man who has come into this area has lived to return. There have been many, believe me. Missionaries, explorers, traders, who have never been heard of again.
But this is the 20th century. Things like this don't happen anymore.
Look around you and see the answer. It does.
Oh, when I think of Copacabana Beach...
Look over there. Something's happening.
It's a man. A European, too.
Oh, thank heavens for that.
Wait. No, he's not a European. Mestizo. A half-caste.
But he must come from some trading post. See, he's wearing trousers and a shirt.
Yes. And the large feathered headdress. You see how they bow to him? This man must be the priest they were chattering about.
He's coming towards us. The Indians are making a passage for him.
Vima Melulu.
It's better we speak in English.
We stared at the Mazizu, and the crowd became hushed.
Where are you from?
Well, I'm English. Miss Nolan here is American.
I am Brazilian.
My name is Zambala. Or rather, that is the name I have adopted. Many years ago, I lived in Manaus. I was called Carlo then.
We're very pleased to see you here, Zambala.
Perhaps not. We shall see. I am the servant of El Medico. For a long time, he has waited for an English and American to come by. We are lucky today. Both at once. El Medico will be very pleased.
Who is El Medico?
We'll meet him very soon now. We will go to his place. You, little fat man. What is your name?
Rico Gomes. I am a pilot for Astra.
I don't care about that. The less I know of your history, the happier I am. As El Medico has no wish to talk with you, There is no further need for you to wait.
You mean I can go?
Certainly. The Indios will help you. Manifesto de Roa!
No, not that! Let me go!
Oh! They're killing him!
Crew, keep back!
Oh, awful.
Look away, Sue.
You, Zambala, why?
El Medico does not wish to talk to Brazilians. We can catch them anytime.
For heaven's sake, man, stop them from sticking those spears into him. He's dead now.
Lashima. Consider yourselves lucky. You are American, English. Your nationalities have given you a little longer to live.
A little longer? You mean you're going to kill us, too?
All strangers who come here must die. But you are privileged to live a few extra hours for the sake of my master, who craves your company. Come, we must go to him now.
Our hearts were so heavy with dread that we barely noticed the route we walked. Still surrounded by our escort of Indian guards, we passed through the village and back into the jungle, Zambala leading the way. Soon the ground began to slope upwards, and the path ended at the entrance to a wide cave mouth. Fixed to the rock outside were innumerable crude wooden figures and symbols, whilst across the entrance itself was a line of 5-foot poles, a yard apart, and topping each one was a grinning human skull.
Oh, what a hideous place.
It is the home of El Medico. The outside is very misleading and meant only to satisfy the superstitions of the Indios. Look, you see the way they stare. They would rather die than pass this line of skulls.
Is this where we get to meet your boss?
Yes, but first a word of warning.
Huh?
Be polite and flattering to El Medico. He will only order your deaths when he tires of your company.
Charming. Sounds like a real nice fellow.
He is. I've been with him for many years now. Come, let us go inside.
Zambala was right. The outside was very misleading. The cavern was really a tunnel, which led 50 yards under the hill to the other side. Built against this far entrance was a timber house, not very big, but substantial. Zambala opened a door and gestured us inside. I gazed around in open amazement. It was a lounge, nicely, if primitively, furnished. What surprised me most was that two of the walls were completely lined with fully stocked bookshelves.
Please make yourselves comfortable. My master will come soon. Don't try to run away, though. The Indios are waiting at the tunnel entrance for you to try.
Well, what do you know about that? This El Medico fellow must be a European.
Yeah, with a highly sophisticated taste, judging by his literature. Most of it's in German, but there's also Shakespeare here and Spencer.
Never mind that, Ken. We've got to do something about getting away from this nut, whoever he is.
Ah, I'm very pleased to meet you. Zambala has just told me about you. May I inquire your names?
I'm Kenneth Driver, and this is Susan Nolan.
Very good. Miss Nolan is American, I presume.
Yes.
I'm known here as El Medico, but my real name is Heinrich Steiger. Welcome to my humble home. As you can see, I've tried to make it as comfortable as possible.
Steiger was an old man, 70 if a day. He was dressed smartly in white, clean and sprightly. A man very much out of place in this green wilderness. He smiled at us, but his thin lips were cruel and needed but a slight change of expression to change the smile into a snarl.
Please sit down. Zambala is bringing us some drinks. Then, I trust, you'll join me in the light lunch.
That's very kind of you, but hadn't you better explain to us what all this is about?
Yes. Why did the Indians murder Art Enrico?
This man, Art, you call him. He was killed in error. As for Azar, he was only a Brazilian. I didn't need him.
Look, are we your guests or prisoners?
Both.
But why? I can't understand your motive.
First, tell me about what is happening in the outside world. I get very little news here, you know. Zambala has been my only contact with civilization for many years. Tell me about Europe and America, the political climate, all the scandals, the troubles. Are the Russians still aggressive?
Steiger pressed Sue and me with questions for over an hour. Then Zambala, who was now playing his part of the butler, announced lunch. We went into a dining room and were served an excellent meal. That our host was quite mad became obvious. Not a raving lunatic, but it could be read in his eyes, in his jerky movements, in his neurotic manner.
There came a lull in the conversation while he digested some of the facts Sue and I had told him.
That was a nice meal, Mr. Steiger.
Dr. Steiger, Miss Nolan.
Oh, of course. Hence your local title of El Medico.
I treat the natives for their aches, pains, and diseases. In return, they think I'm a god and give me their absolute loyalty and protection. Zambala is my high priest and mediator. Masvei, I taught him to speak your language. He does it well, don't you think?
Tell me, if you will, what you are planning to do with us.
Have you killed? But later, no hurry.
But why?
I could wring your scraggy little neck.
That would be a foolish thing to do. The Indians would spend a week killing you both. Very, very slowly. At least, when you die by my hand, it will be quick. I promise you that.
But this is sheer madness. Why can't you just let us go?
Yes, Sue's right. We could get a canoe from the Indians and paddle up
river. I cannot permit you to leave here alive. Don't you recognize me? Or my name? Does Heinrich Steiger mean nothing to you at all?
Nothing at all. Should it?
Oh, has it been so long that I'm now a forgotten man?
You're a wanted man. Is that it? You're wanted by the police.
I shall tell you. But first, let us have a drink. Zambala, bring us all another drink.
The time is before Senorita Nolan.
Please.
And your driver?
Yes, the same, please.
So, the world has forgotten Heinrich Steiger. That is good.
What did you do?
I was the doctor in charge of the experimental unit in Rosmank concentration camp.
A war criminal?
Yes. That is what they called me. But they exaggerated by saying I killed 10,000 prisoners. It was not so. 8,000 would have been more accurate.
You murdered 8,000 people.
It was my job. War is war. These people were the enemies of the Reich.
It's monstrous.
Put down the drink, Zambala. Then go and wait at the cave entrance.
I see. There's nothing else you want?
Nothing. To continue. First, the British, Russians, French, and Americans hunted me down. When they gave up, I heard that the Jews tried to take up the search. All these years I've lived here, safe. It was hard at first, but I soon became accustomed to the isolation. Now you see why I dare not let you go. If the authorities know that a white man lives here alone, they will suddenly get very nosy.
What can they do now? The war finished 29 years ago.
Revenge for my so-called crimes. I'm an old man, but I have no wish to die yet.
But there was an amnesty. You're a free man. There's no need to hide out here anymore.
An amnesty, you say? You mean I'm not wanted now?
I didn't know about that, Ken.
You should read your papers, Sue. Yes, 3 years ago. Was it four? It was decided no longer to charge war criminals.
If this is true,
then there's no point in killing us.
No! Don't drink that!
What's wrong?
Don't touch your drink either, Mr. Driver. They're both poisoned.
You are going to kill us. Now.
Yes. But as you can see, circumstances have changed. I want to go back to civilization. Just to see what it is like. Zambala can guide us. It is 5 days' march from here to an old Indian trail. Zambala knows it well. We come out of the jungle at a small Colombian town and...
You're not going to kill us now?
No. We're all going together. We are friends.
The sudden change in Steiger's manner astonished us. It was painfully obvious that he'd longed to be able to leave his jungle retreat. We don't know what he told Zambala, but the next morning we left the cave and started the long march westwards into Colombia. It was an arduous journey, through alternating rocky and dense jungle terrain. As we drew closer, Steiger's excitement grew until he was like a small boy at a picnic. On the morning of the fifth day, we stopped on the brow of a hill. Ahead of us was a wide path. Zambala pointed to it.
There is the road. It leads into Contapa. We can reach the town by noon.
So, you have done well, Zambala.
Do you want me to go back to the tribe or stay here until you return?
Zambala, I have decided not to go back to the tribe. I'm going to rejoin my own people. I have no further use for you.
Steiger was the only one of us armed, and he pulled out his revolver.
You're going to kill me? After I have served you for so long?
Steiger, don't!
You two keep away. This is my business.
Why'd you do that, Steiger?
Why not? There's no future for him. He was nothing but a nasty little pickpocket in Manaus before I took him under my wing. Come, let us go.
You have no respect for the value of human life, have you?
Oh, please do not moralize to me, Miss Nolan. People who have no value should be destroyed. Too many are parasites. But we cannot stand here arguing.
Look, Steiger. Zambala's still alive.
He is still...
As the old man turned to look, I jumped forward and grabbed for the gun. I managed to wrest it from his grip. He stood back and looked reproachfully at me.
I see. So you're going to kill me?
No, Steiger. I'm not a killer.
Why are you taking out the bullets?
All but one. I'm leaving you a choice. Kill yourself or go back to your Indian tribe.
I cannot go back. Without Zambala, they will kill me.
That's your problem.
I'm going into Kantapa with you.
Once they know who you really are, you'll be arrested on sight.
But amnesty!
What amnesty? I was only telling you that to play for time, and you swallowed it. The world would never forgive your crimes in a million years. You're a dead man, Steiger, and it's up to you how you want to go out.
So you tricked me. Traded on my need for company. Civilized company.
You see that rock over there? Midway between here and the road? I'm going to leave this gun on top of it. Don't try to chase us and use the one bullet. It wouldn't do you any good. Merely ruin your one chance of taking the easy way out. Now stay here, Steiger, until you see me wave. From then on, it's up to you. Come on, Sue. Goodbye, Dr. Steiger. I left the pistol on the rock, and we walked away down to the road, where I waved my hand to Steiger. Then Sue and I carried on walking. A few minutes later, I looked back and saw the lonely figure standing silhouetted on top of the rock where I had left the revolver. It was all over. The nightmare had ended.
High Adventure is produced by Anne Freed and directed by Henry Diffenthal.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY in an episode of High Adventure entitled Drums Along the River. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows. On the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at this same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.